Happy Mother's Day. Today is Mother's Day. If you didn't already know, you're probably in trouble. It's a special time that we are able to take to honor those women in our lives that we see as mother. Those women who have reared us or that we see rearing others, those mothers that we appreciate so much that carry us and bring us into the world and then carry us some more. We see God's love in loving mothers, in a mother's gentle tenderness handling her newborn child. We see, we're reminded of God's loving care, in a mother's sincere sympathy for scraped knees and broken hearts, we're reminded of God's compassion. And in a loving mother's sacrificial selflessness, giving of herself, putting her child's needs before her own, we are reminded of God's benevolence and sacrifice for us. I'm so thankful for mothers and that God created mothers and people who would take care of children. And today is a day that we honor them. But it always, when I think about it, when I reflect on my own relationship with mothers in my life, I begin to wonder, how does a mother become a mother? Where does that change take place? There has to do with the child, right? A child comes along, and then once you become a mother, there's no going back. From then on, you're always a mother. Your identity can never be fully separated from motherhood. You're no longer known around the house as sweetheart and honey and Trisha and Bae. You're known as mama and mom. Your identity is changing. You're no longer best described as the woman sitting in the back with a pink shirt. You know, now you're better known as Strider's mom, as Ashley's mom, as Julie and Abby and Rebecca and Jennifer, Lily's mom, and I can't go through all the names, it would take too long. But that's how you become known. So mothers are willingly and selflessly laying down their former identities, and we're so thankful for that sacrifice. And this Mother's Day, that sacrifice will also be a reminder for us that in God's kingdom, we are called by God to have a similar identity shift in our lives. We're called to make a sacrifice that radically changes the way we see ourselves and the way we see others in our life. Jesus gives us a glimpse into this kingdom truth in Luke chapter 10. But before we get to that truth, we need to start at the beginning here. Luke chapter 10, beginning in verse 25. And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus said to him, "What is written in the law? How do you read it?" And he answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus said to him, "You have answered correctly. Do this, and you will live." The lawyer asked, "What should I do to get life?" And in verse 28, Jesus confirms what he should do to get life. But these two commands, they come from the Old Testament, the law, Deuteronomy 6, 5, and Leviticus 19, 18. They're not simple to fulfill as they initially sound. Just speaking them sounds simple, but they are a little more difficult to fulfill than that. In Matthew 22, 40, Jesus tells us that all the law and prophets hang on these two commandments. That means the entire law and the prophets, the Old Testament, only describe what keeping these two commands looks like. Another way to say it is that the entire law and the prophets would be followed if one could fully keep these two commandments. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. But the lawyer in verse 22, he seeks to justify himself. He says to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" He wants to get it right. That's what it means. He wants to justify himself. He wants to be sure he gets these two laws right. And as a lawyer, he likes definitions. So he's going to go back to these two laws. He's already got the summary of his law book here. And now he's going to go back and get definitions. And he says, "Who is my neighbor?" And it's funny that he starts there. He must have been okay with all the rest of the words there. He must have been okay with loving God with all his heart, soul, strength, and mind, because he's only worried about that one definition. It's almost as if he's saying, "I don't want to love too much. I don't want to love the wrong person. But I want to be sure I go ahead and love all Jews. I want to be sure I love maybe even the tax collectors. If they're Jews and I should love them, I want to make sure I get that part right so that I can just be justified and have this eternal life." So he asked Jesus, "Can you tell me, am I supposed to love as myself? Who am I supposed to love as myself? Who is this neighbor? Please give me the definition of neighbor. Please give me the identity of who I'm supposed to love." And now we come to this parable in verse 30. I'm going to try not to get too deep into this parable, not to break in too many times, because this is one of my favorite parables to read. It teaches so much. I mean, we're talking about the two greatest commands on which all of the Old Testament law and prophets hung. You should expect that this parable would be deep, and it is. It is deep. It describes these greatest commands. And in verse 30, we read, Jesus replies, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead." This is about a 17-mile trip from Jerusalem to Jericho, and it's all downhill. It drops about 200 feet per mile. And this is a barren land, a desolate place where there are plenty of places for robbers to hide. This story wouldn't be too unfamiliar to people listening to Jesus, to this lawyer who's hearing this. In verse 31, he says, "Now by chance a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side." A priest is obviously a religious leader of the day. They served in Jerusalem, usually for 2-week periods at a time, and then they could go home. They were expected to help their fellow Jews. But this man was half dead and naked. There's no way this priest could know for sure that this was a Jew. If the man died, in fact, even if it was a Jew, if the man died, the priest would then become defiled and have to head back up the hill to Jerusalem for a whole week of purification, in which time he would not be allowed to partake of the tithes. He would not be able to eat that food because he would then defile it. He would not even be able to do his job as a priest and, give money to the poor and feed the poor. He wouldn't be able to do that because he would be defiled. This would be a severe inconvenience for this priest. If we're honest with ourselves, we give ourselves similar excuses. "I'm late for work," right? "I can't be bothered by this fellow who doesn't even know how to change a tire." Then on the way home, it's funny how it changes into, "I've been working like a dog all day. I can't be bothered to stop and help this fellow who doesn't know how to change his own tire." We don't like this priest, but we can see sometimes a reflection of ourselves in him. No one is immune from this excuse of inconvenience. There was a research study at Princeton in 1973 Some theology students were told that they had to get across campus and give a sermon. And they were told that they were already late. They had to get there quickly. And unbeknownst to them, they had an actor playing a role of a victim lying in the sidewalk where they would have to pass by that person. But because they were in a hurry, 90% of those students passed right by. Some of them even had to step over the victim in their rush. Priests and preachers are not immune to this inconvenience excuse. Neither are any of us immune to this excuse of inconvenience. Look at verse 32. Likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place, he saw the man and passed by on the other side. The Levite does exactly what the priest does. He sees the man and he passes by on the other side. And again, we're left to wonder at his reasoning. Jesus doesn't tell us exactly why the priest passed. He doesn't tell us exactly why the Levite passed, but we can come up with good reasoning for ourselves, right? I'll tell you a little bit about Levites. They were usually priests' assistants in the temple. And we can imagine easily a scenario where the priest is heading home from working for his two-week stay in Jerusalem, and now here comes his assistant behind him on the road to Jericho on his way home. And traveling on the same road, coming from the same place, going to the same place, they may have known each other, and it's perfectly feasible that this Levite knew that the priest was right in front of him. And he may have been close enough to be able to see him. Because the man's lying half dead, how much more time does he have? And what he sees is that the priest passes by on the other side, and we can imagine the religious man up ahead sets the president. He sets the example for the man following him, the Levite. You know, the Levite's thinking, maybe he knows something I don't know. Maybe there's something in the law that says I shouldn't help this guy. Or maybe even the Levite or the priest has gone for help himself. You've probably heard the story of Kitty Genovese. Everybody know that story? Oh, you actually recognize the name. Okay. You will know the story when I'm done, probably. Kitty Genovese was attacked early one morning in New York on her way home from work. As she screamed, over a dozen people heard her cries, her neighbors, through their windows, but they did nothing. They didn't call the police for help. They heard them and they assumed that somebody else would call the police. Somebody else was going to take care of this situation. Or maybe it's just this woman, this Kitty down there that we all know. Maybe she's having a domestic spat. She is coming home quite late. Maybe this is just, you know, an argument between a married couple. Well, since nobody called, Kitty had to drag herself around back to the back door. And as she was crawling in, the police didn't show up and her attacker returned to finish the job. And nobody called the police, even though she continued to scream out that she needed help. Not until after everything was done did somebody finally call the police. Everyone assumed that somebody else was going to take care of it, just like this Levite in our story. You know, the priest knows better, right? And maybe the priest is helping out. No one in the story of Kitty Genovese wants to be presumptuous and intrude on other people's business. If they're hashing it out between husband and wife, that's up to them. You know? That's not for me to intrude. Then Jesus goes on after he talks about this priest, and people's mind wander about the reasoning, and the Levite and people have time to think about the reasoning. In verse 33, but a Samaritan. This is a villain to the Jews. This is a bad guy. They're considered half-breeds to the Jew. They're not fully Jew, and they're not exactly Gentile either. They're unclean. It wasn't too long ago that the Samaritans had actually desecrated the temple in Jerusalem, sprinkling bone dust all over the place. they're unclean. If the Samaritan discovers the wounded man perhaps is in fact a Jew, everybody's expecting, listening to this story, that this Samaritan's probably just going to kick him and make it worse. Jesus says, "But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. He went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, 'Take care of him. And whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back.'" This is all very inconvenient. This is all very presumptuous. To think that this Samaritan thinking, I have to take care of this guy, and nobody's going to show up, and I'm even going to come back in a few days. He bound his wounds. He poured oil and wine on them. He walked the rest of the way to Jericho. He put the man on his animal and walked the rest of the way. He took care of him at this inn overnight. And when morning came and he had responsibilities, he didn't leave the man there. He paid so that he would be taken care of for the next few days, and he vowed to return. See, it's one thing to take care of this man's wounds, and it's one thing to bring him to this inn, but the Samaritan was looking out for this man's future. This man had no way to identify himself. When he wakes up at this inn, if he has no way to pay for it, he would be put into servitude until he could pay it off. And a lot of people ended up slaves in that way. But here's a Samaritan making sure that does not happen. Who does something like this? This is like not only changing the tire, but following the guy to the mechanic's shop, and then paying for the new tire, and making sure he makes it home, and then saying, "I'll come back. Just call me anytime you have a flat tire or anything like this. Here's my cell phone number. 24 hours a day, you give me a call." Who does this? Then Jesus asked the question in answer to the lawyer's question, "Who is my neighbor?" Verse 36, "Which of these do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers?" The lawyer shows a little bit of his disdain for Samaritans in his answer. He doesn't even call the man a Samaritan. He says, "The one who showed mercy." And Jesus said to him, "You go and do likewise." Jesus tells him, "Go and be like the Samaritan." You can imagine him saying, "Wear this WWSD bracelet. What would the Samaritan do? Remember this story, lawyer, every time that you come up and wonder if this person should be my neighbor, if I should treat him like my neighbor. Think about what the Samaritan did." See, there's all kinds of aspects here. We could get into all kinds of discussions on race and religion and politics and all kinds of things. But what's the story about? There's more to this story than just the racial issue and the disagreements between the two nations here. The question the lawyer asked was, "Who is my neighbor?" And Jesus' answer was, "Who was a neighbor to the man?" He didn't say your neighbor is Jews, and he doesn't even say that your neighbor is Samaritans, which would be hard for him to swallow. And he doesn't even say your neighbor is everybody. Everybody you see is your neighbor. He doesn't just leave it at that. He tells this story. He doesn't define a neighbor in a way that would put boundaries around love. Because the law is love your neighbor. Rather than answer who is a neighbor, Jesus says you be a neighbor. You be the one showing neighbor love. Love your neighbor as yourself. And your neighbor is whomever you are showing neighbor love to. There are no boundaries. This parable like so many, takes the lawyer's world and turns it upside down. It's not about the identity of the neighbor who you're supposed to love. It's about your identity as a neighbor. It's about your identity being defined by your love. How do you like that? Is your identity defined by your love? I know this is all a little bit repetitive, but we're talking about a change of perspective that Jesus is teaching here. It comes with being in the kingdom. It comes with God's kingdom, this change of perspective. And it's sometimes hard to keep a hold of this idea. You know, those theology students who were told to rush across campus and deliver a sermon, who stepped over the man who was suffering in the middle of the sidewalk. You know what they are told to preach on? The Good Samaritan. These are more than just words. It's about your identity as a neighbor. And it's about your identity as someone who loves God. If you're loving God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, loving your neighbor is just something you do as you're loving God. That's why the question the lawyer asked and the answers don't seem to match up, because the question is the wrong question to ask. If you rightly understand God's love, you understand that there are no boundaries to the definition of neighbor. And when we get to this point, the love of the Samaritan was an inconvenience. To love without boundaries is risky. To love without boundaries is dangerous. But we're told to love enemies. We're told to bless those who curse. And through this story and thinking about it, we begin to see why so many martyrs exist in Christian history. Because loving like a neighbor is dangerous. This week, ask yourself, what are the limits of my love? What are the limits of God's love? And then go and do likewise. Each Christian undergoes an identity shift when you become a Christian, and it's a deadly one. Paul says in Galatians 2:20, I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life that I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. We no longer live being crucified. Christ lives in us. Christ is your identity, Christian. What does Christ's love look like, and where is it in your life? Are you a neighbor? Do you show neighbor love the way that Christ did? The way that Christ was a neighbor? Let's not be like the priest or the Levite who see what needs to be done but just pass by because of the inconvenience or because of whatever excuse we want to come up with. This parable, as we read it, forces us to do something. If we read it and understand it and do nothing, we are exactly like the priest and the Levite. We are just passing by. This parable forces us to love actively, which is godly. It forces us to live by faith, which is to live Christ, that identity that comes from Christ. It comes with eternal life, which is what the lawyer wanted to know about in the first place. It's not something that is earned, but it's a gift from God, according to Romans 6:23. And it's not just some new title. It is who God made us. He made us to be something new, according to 2 Corinthians 5:17 and 18. If you're a Christian, you are a neighbor. All we have to do is act like it. if you're struggling to live this out, if you're struggling to live out Christ fully in your life and you'd like the prayers of your fellow sons and daughters of God, or if you've never obeyed Christ's call, there's an opportunity today for you to become something more than a mere human, a mere man or woman, but to become Christ's.